I worked for the Daily Press there in Hampton, at that time, white family-owned newspaper. While I was near the top of my class and had excellent grades, they would not put me in the newsroom. They put me in the circulation department with the promise that I would get in the newsroom. And after 2 years, I'm like, okay, I saw other people get hired in the newsroom. There's something wrong here. And that's when I decided I need to continue to pursue my education in order to continue to improve my life.
Hello and welcome to A Pixie from Kilmarnock. A program about people, places, and the history of the Northern Neck of Virginia. I'm your host, Pixie E. Curry. I lived my first 13 years of life in a segregated world, without an inkling as to what was beyond the shores of the Northern Neck, I dreamed of something other than my daily existence of living in a small southern town, limited by deep-rooted attitudes, not sure of how to make those dreams come true. For the most part, it could have just remained a dream, because reality was that I was a colored girl and someone had decided that I shouldn't be any more than what was imposed upon me. I was enclosed in a stone wall. A wall that was in place for so many generations in so many other communities, designed to enclose people of color to prevent any measure of success for the individuals as well as the community as a whole. The stones of suppression, discrimination, intimidation, and racism were cemented by the long-standing history of separation of the races and the denial of rights to anyone of color. The cement was weakening. The black community's tools made of sharp wit, quiet determination, and combined efforts made a way to break down that wall and eventually made the wall to crumble. And where the stones landed were used to pave a road to achievements, but not yet for all. Once the wall was broken down, the victors used those stones to throw at the ignorance that was Jim Crow. And where the stones landed were used to pave a road to achievements. While interviewing the many talented and gifted people who lived and live on the neck and hearing their success stories, I was inspired by how they experienced and dismantled that shared stonewalled existence. This interview is about one of those people who supplies the necessary tools to break down those still existing stone walls. I interviewed Edwin Walker in March of 2022. He used the sage advice of his elders and the knowledge and encouragement from supportive family, friends, and teachers to rise above pettiness, limited opportunities, and the isolation associated to a small southern town where Jim Crow lived. Edwin is one of the many who weathered the transition between segregation and integration. He epitomized the drive, the focus, the dedication of preparing for what was beyond the boundaries imposed by racism and the lack of opportunities in a tiny rural community. Allow me to introduce Edwin Walker, Deputy Assistant Secretary for Aging with the United States Department of Health and Human Services.
Edwin Walker, currently the Deputy Assistant Secretary for Aging with the U.S. Administration on Aging, an agency within the Administration for Community Living. It's an agency within the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services at the federal level. I've received the Department of Health and Human Services Secretary's Distinguished Service Award. I've received that twice. I've received the Presidential Rank Award for Meritorious Service. I've received one that I'm very excited about. It's the Sam Simmons Excellence and Achievement Award. I received that during the 2005 White House Conference on Aging. And Sam Simmons was the former Deputy Assistant Secretary at the Department of Housing and Urban Development under President Carter. But during the time that I knew him, he was the Executive Director of the National Center and Caucus on Black Aging. I've also received the Leadership in Aging Lifetime Achievement Award from the state of Maryland, which I'm very proud of. That's the sum of the awards that I've received. In terms of degrees, I am very proud to say that I received a Bachelor of Arts degree in Mass Media Arts from Hampton Institute. Now it is Hampton University. And I received my Juris Doctor degree from the University of Missouri in Columbia, Missouri. I was born in Richmond, Virginia, at Community Hospital, which was the Black hospital at the time, and that was in August of 1956. I'm a baby boomer, proud of it, and I totally embrace aging.
So what hometown?
I grew up in Heathsville, but that's what we told the people who weren't from the Northern Neck. But I really grew up in Horsehead. So for those of you who know Horsehead, that's where I was born and raised.
What school did you graduate from?
Well, I graduated from Northumberland High School. I attended there from grades 10 through 12, but, you know, I started at Fairfields Elementary School. I think I was the first class that went to Fairfields for the full year, the first full year of schooling when Fairfields first opened. They as I recall, they opened mid-year, so the class above me went for half a year, but you know, I was the first full year first grader at Fairfields Elementary, and I went there from grades 1 through 6. Then I went to Calliel Elementary for grade 7, and then I went to Northumberland Junior High, which formerly was Central High School, for grades 8 and 9.
When you started school in the first grade, schools were still segregated?
Oh, yes. Schools were segregated until I got to junior high school, actually. And in fact, so from grades 1 through 6, it was fully segregated. And then for grade 7, when I went to Calio, that was part of the freedom of choice movement, where it was a coordinated strategy of the African-American families to actually overcrowd the white schools in order to force integration. Where we lived in Horsehead, there was a white girl who lived directly across the road from us. My brothers and I would watch her get picked up on a new school bus while we wondered if our leftover old school bus was even going to make it to school or make it to pick us up. And so we grew up in a segregated community, but that strategy of freedom of choice really worked because it did overcrowd the schools and classified at the time I got to my eighth year, integration did occur.
What choice did your parents make for you?
The choice we made was to leave Fairfield, signed up for Calio, the white school, and we overcrowded Calio. They had to put up trailers because we had so many additional students, all black, who signed up to go to Calio. Just like I think down the other part of the county, they overcrowded Reedville School and overcrowded them. It forced integration in the county at the time, in the Northern Neck, actually.
Who were some of your favorite teachers as you started your education?
Well, you know, I thought about some of my teachers. My first grade teacher was Ms. Burley Smith, and she was very influential in my life. It's also significant that she was my Sunday school teacher at church, and she was the musician at church, and got us in the youth choir and the regular choir, and got us up speaking and talking and all of that. I always mention Ms. Burley Smith, but I also think of Ms. Gladys Haney, who was my history teacher in the fifth and sixth grade. And then when I got into high school, Ms. Grace DeKeeve, who taught geometry in the 10th, and Ms. Helen Basie, who taught sociology for my 11th and 12th grade years. And I distinctly remember your sister being in my sociology class. We had a good time.
My sister Angela.
Yes.
Being part of that freedom of choice movement, what were some of the challenges that you faced that first year?
Well, for the freedom of choice year, for me, the challenges were just, it was uncertain. Initially, we didn't know exactly how we were going to be received, but we didn't encounter a lot of opposition. I think that, and I'll give credit to the white teachers we had at Calio, who, to the best of their ability, embraced us and tried to incorporate us into what had been their world. I can't say that's the case for every student, but kids are kids and they come from different families, and we understand that. So I didn't really encounter that much at that point. It was really after we were in junior high and high school, where integration was forced, that we began to see some resistance. And I vividly recall that there were some, I wouldn't call them race riots, but there were some scramble within the school among the students. And it just, for me, just didn't make sense because I thought we should all be together and that we should all be focused on what we were there to, what we were at school to do. And so when I vividly remember when I ran for student government president at Northumberland High, my speech is still in my head, and it was all about change. It was all about we should work together as one student body to bring about changes that would benefit the entire student body. And apparently that resonated because I was the elected student government president and think we had a very successful time bridging the races for the benefit of the entire student body.
Being inclusive into the white world, was it also trying to include black culture and their world to be taught to the white students?
I would say that I did not experience that in Northumberland High or in Northumberland Junior High, and certainly not at Calio. I don't think they had that degree of consciousness at that point to know that they should even consider us to that level. That was not my experience at all. Now, certainly the black teachers that we had retained as much as they could and incorporated within the curriculum as much as they could so that there would be a better balance in terms of the curriculum that we had and the learnings that we were taught. Uh-huh. Now, to their credit, though, I will say this, and I don't remember her name. There was a white English teacher that I had at Northumberland High School who, while she, I don't recall that she actually actively taught black literature or black poetry, but she encouraged us to explore it. And as you may know, you know, I won one of the state championships in terms of forensics, and I did black dialect from Paul Lawrence Dunbar. She helped me with that, and she was thrilled as I was in terms of the poetry that I found, and that she was fully encouraging in terms of what I did.
What was your first job?
In the Northern Neck. Mm-hmm. Well, my very first job, it was a job, was picking tomatoes for Johnny Kelly for 5 cents a basket. In the hot sun, I won't say it was any fun.
I didn't know tomato picking was such a big, big industry on the Northern Neck. So that was your first job. What was your earliest recollection of racism on the Neck?
Well, you know, I would say that the issues of race and the distinctions of race were simply just a part of life. But my earliest personal impact story, I think, occurred when I was either 4 or probably 5 years old. I had my mother wanted to take me to Heathsville to get my vaccinations before starting school. And she told me that if I didn't cry after getting my shot, that I could have a milkshake. And so at that time in Heathsville, there was a soda fountain shop. And I wanted that milkshake, so I made sure I didn't cry. And as we walked into that soda fountain shop, I admired the long, what seemed like the longest lunch counter in the world, filled with white folks sitting there with sodas and soda floats and milkshakes in these pretty glasses in a chrome holder. And they looked like the most delicious things in the world. I'll never forget it. But we couldn't sit at the counter, and we couldn't even order at the counter. I vividly remember how, with every white person's eyes zeroed in on us and following us every step of the way, we had to walk down the length of that counter from the front of the store all the way to the back of the store, turn the corner, and order from the back end of the counter. And then we received my milkshake in a paper cup that had to be consumed outside. We had to carry it outside in order to drink it. And, you know, for me, that's a story that's always stuck with me because it really reflected life at that time. It reflected the inequities, and it reflected the unfairness when there was no reason for it.
Since you was telling me about some of your favorite teachers, what person motivated you as you was growing up?
Well, I honestly believe the person that motivated me the most, apart from my parents, of course, was my grandmother. And I'm talking about Ella Walker. She was a strong, independent woman whose father was a white man, who was as fair as her half-brothers and sisters, but was treated unfairly and certainly not on equal terms as her half-brothers and sisters. And she taught us, all of her grandchildren, that we had to be twice as good in order to be recognized that we were as good. And that's a principle that I think stuck with each of her grandchildren and really guided our lives, that we pursued excellence and that it was necessary in order to be accepted in this world, a world that was inequitable and unfair, and to truly show white people that we were as good, we deserved to be treated fairly.
When and why did you leave the Northern Neck?
I always laugh about this story because I graduated in June of 1974. I spoke at graduation. My car was packed at graduation, and I left that night. There were really no opportunities for work in the Northern Neck. I mean, the industries were fishing or farming, and unless you did one or the other, there wasn't much else to do. So I left at that point. I came to Washington, D.C. to get a nice summer job, and I left the Northern Neck in June of 1974.
So what was that job that you were looking for?
Well, I was just looking for employment, period. I was just looking for a summer job, you know, as they say, a good government job. And I worked for, at that time, I worked for the D.C. Department of Human Resources. Marion Barry had a summer jobs program and employed youth. And so to his credit, I became employed for the summer prior to going to Hampton for school, and it served me very well. It gave me the necessary resources I needed, you know, to buy my books asked them to live while on campus.
That first summer job, did that help to guide you to your present occupation?
In a very remote way, but not directly. In terms of my present occupation, people often ask, well, how did you get into this area? And I tell the story that I fell into the field of aging. It wasn't my plan, but it has become my passion. In Missouri, following law school, I'll tell you this story as a tidbit. I finished Hampton in mass media arts, which is journalism and all. I worked for the Daily Press there in Hampton, which was, at that time, a white family-owned newspaper. But And while I was near the top of my class and had excellent grades, they would not put me in the newsroom. They put me in the circulation department, and with the promise that I would get in the newsroom. And after 2 years, I'm like, okay, I saw other people get hired in the newsroom. There's something wrong here. And that's when I decided I need to continue to pursue my education in order to continue to improve my life. And I went to law school. So after law school, my wife was chronically ill toward the end of my career at law school, and my student insurance was about to run out. So more than anything else in the world, I needed a good group health plan. So I went to the state, and I applied for it. I told them, I want anything I'm remotely qualified for. I don't really care what it is. I need health insurance. And the Division of Aging was the first place to call me for an interview, and I didn't know anything about aging. But later, it's something I learned that I must have been destined to do. You see, I was taught by my grandmother and the larger Northern Neck community to respect my elders. That's the way we were raised at that time. And I know that I have a heart toward older people. So I was hired into an entry-level job, not an attorney position, but just an entry-level job. And I worked hard and I worked my way up to become the director of that agency. And I was able to do some innovative things. I had a great team of people, and we just connected and did wonderful things for the people of Missouri, older individuals in Missouri. And that got noticed, and eventually I was asked to come to Washington to a federal position to replicate what I had done in the state and to do that for all states. And I have really fallen in love with the field of aging. As I said, it resonates with me. It's a part of who I am. And I believe that God gave me a heart for older people. And so it's been a great fit. I think I've been responsible and responsive to it. It has been wonderful for me.
Some of your fondest memories of living on the Neck.
Some of my fondest memories of living on the Neck, I think, include the Neck itself. It's the water. It's the forest. It's the land. I love walking around and being in a peaceful, serene setting. The Neck sort of provides that. But I think, as I think about the people, for me, the Neck provided the necessary foundations for success. It was a sense of community. It was a sense of, you know, how they say it takes a village to raise a child. And I believe that the Neck did that. I really do. I think that the people worked with one another. Everyone took interest in the issues and needs of others. And there was a sense of community that is simply lost in too many places around in this country today. People are now selfish and self-centered, and they're not giving, and they're not going to give of themselves to other people. That's the environment in which I was raised in the Northern Neck. And, you know, I often talk about how it was unique, I think, in a way, because as I've left the Neck and other people have left the Neck, we have found that a number of us have just been successful. And it's because of those foundations that were rooted in us, those Christian values that were rooted in us, and the sense of community that was rooted in us.
You're absolutely right. For all the bad, there's so much more good.
Mm-hmm.
What did you do for fun?
For fun?
For fun.
In the neck?
Yeah.
Well, I mean, we were kids. So at that time, there were no video games. So we played outside. We rode our bikes. We went hunting. We were kids. We hung on trees and climbed. We just hung out. We related to one another. That's what we did for fun. Then when we were old enough to have cars and ride around, we went to the Dairy Freeze and just hung out, had fun there too. But you know what else we used to do? We used to play Pinochle. We had fun playing Pinochle.
And Rook?
And Rook, yes, indeed.
Families used to go from house to house to play Pinochle or Rook.
And that's right.
And someone was in charge of the score sheet. And the games would go on for months.
That's right.
Card games and board games.
That's right.
But it was a way of socializing, just having fun. What were some of your favorite foods that is sort of indicative to the neck that you love?
I wouldn't be from there if I didn't say fresh fish and oysters, okay? And I still love them to this day. So whenever I can get some fresh fish and oysters, I'm on it. I love fresh vegetables, too. I mean, you know, I love it's amazing sometimes when we talk about how people live, because I can remember somebody in the neck, you could live on a lot less because people always brought you stuff. They bring you a mess of fish, or they bring you stuff out of their garden, or, you know, it was just always this concept of sharing whatever you had with others. And so I appreciate that. Now, one thing I'm not fond of today, because I had too many of them, was peaches, because my oldest brother, one of his first jobs was picking peaches. We would get all of the, you know, they had to pick peaches that weren't too ripe, or else they wouldn't ship well. All these peaches that were about to be a little too ripe always made their way to our house. So we had peaches on ice cream. We had peach pie. We had peach cobbler. We had peach everything. Anything you can imagine you can put a peach in, we had peaches of. So if I never have another peach in my life, I'm okay. I'm okay.
I can remember foolishly complaining, what, soft crabs again? And now I would hurt a person to get to a soft crab. Yes, get out of my way. Soft crab calling my name. Oh, my gosh, isn't that something? Do you remember drinking Northern Neck ginger ale?
I do, and yes, I missed it. And it was special. You know, it had a unique bite. It had, and that bite I haven't found anywhere else. I've tried all other types of ginger ale, and nothing is quite the same. People hoarded the final bottles of it, so if I find somebody with one, I'll talk to them real sweet.
Promise them a peach.
All right, gotcha. All right, deal.
They'll never know. You are listening to an interview with Edwin Walker, Deputy Assistant Secretary for Aging with the United States Administration on Aging, on A Pixie from Kilmonic. Edwin and I both love our Northern Neck Ginger Ale. Advocate Stephanie Johnson started a Facebook group about the beloved drink. Hear how deep that communal love goes.
I know that this drink is bigger than what Coca-Cola made it to be. This drink is much more. And the reason I'm passionate about it is because it actually brings people together. And in this society now, we need something to bring us all together. And if it's sitting down somewhere and drinking a Northern Neck, that's what it needs to be. Always said that if a person in Congress had a drink on one side and had a drink on the other side, it would be a Northern Neck ginger ale. Because everybody would come together then and realize, hey, this is really good. That's how it is.
What do you think about the fact that critical race theory is not to be allowed in schools?
I think that a number of things have happened. I think the concept of critical race theory is not clear in terms of what people really are advocating be taught. And as a result, it has been allowed to be distorted by those who oppose it, not even knowing exactly what it is or why it is important. So I'm not going to use the term critical race theory. I'm going to use the term just teaching people all of America's history, okay? Because that's what it's really all about. It's the fact of there are good things about history, there are bad things that happen in history, and we should know about each of those so that we can learn and move forward and not allow history to repeat itself. That's my thought.
You are involved with a tribal elders program.
It's one of the many programs we operate. I administer the Older Americans Act, which was passed in 1965 as part of President Johnson's three-part strategy to combat the war on poverty. At that time, older individuals in this country primarily lived in poverty without any access to health care or physician services or community services to help them. In July of 1965, he passed Medicare, Medicaid, and the Older Americans Act. Medicare and Medicaid, everyone knows about. The Older Americans Act, not many people know about. And that's because the other two are entitlements. They grow automatically. The Older Americans Act is an appropriated piece of legislation dependent upon the good graces of the Congress. And so sometimes it grows, sometimes it doesn't, but it hasn't grown as much as it should. Within the Older Americans Act, it was designed to, with a wonderful mission. And this is also why I continue to do what I do. It's very mission-oriented. It's designed to improve or maintain the health of older individuals and to assist them to maintain their independence, their dignity, and their quality of life, and to enable them to live where they prefer, which is in their own homes and communities. I've never met a person who wanted to go to a nursing home. So what we do is we provide an array of services and supports in the community to allow them to do that, to enable them to do that. It's just services, supports, systems that help people. And it's very consistent from a mission standpoint to Christian missions. It's that you help those who are disenfranchised. And yet we know we don't have enough money to help everybody, so we what's called targeting. We target to those in greatest social and economic need, with particular attention to low-income minorities, people who reside in rural areas, limited English-speaking individuals, and people at risk of going into an institution. In 1978, an additional section was added saying, but there is a whole different group of people who have a completely different set, more intense set of needs. Those people are American Indians, Alaska Natives, and Native Hawaiians. And as a result, especially with American Indians, they live not only in rural areas, but very remote areas. And they just don't, they should. I mean, this country negotiated treaties with them, signed treaties with them, that says, we're going to take care of you. We haven't fulfilled that promise. So the Older Americans Act allows us to provide services and supports through funding to, and we fund 282 different tribes, federally recognized tribes serving more than 400 different tribal communities. And so we provide a level of services and supports that enable them to achieve that mission, live independently, maintain their health, live with dignity. I love what I do.
Is there a website that I can go to get more information?
The primary portal for us is ACL.gov. ACL stands for the Administration for Community Living. And if you go to that website, you will be able to access all of our programs. Let me explain a little bit about what ACL means, the Administration for Community Living. It was created in 2012. It was created under the notion because, as I mentioned, I work within the Administration on Aging portion, which was a standalone agency. But in 2012, we saw that many of our issues and many issues of people with disabilities were the same or similar, and that by joining forces, we would have greater numbers and greater strength to continue to advocate for the needs of people who need support and assistance. And so rather than name the new agency the Administration for Aging and Disabilities, or Disability and Aging, we decided to name it for the aspirations of the community, which, or aspirations of the people, which is community living. Both sets of people want to live in their own homes and communities. They don't want to be in an institution. Our website is acl.gov. And from there, you can see a summary of each of our programs, whether they're aging programs or disability programs, and the array of services and supports we have throughout this country to assist people to achieve that goal of community living. Our nutrition services program, and I'm pleased to say that this is March. It is National Nutrition Month, and we are celebrating the 50th anniversary of our national nutrition program called the Senior Nutrition Program. It is our most popular program. People who don't even know it's a federal program, people have heard of Meals on Wheels. That's us. We provide the funding, and we contract with 20,000 service providers throughout the country to provide nutritious services, meals, and home and community-based supports throughout the country every day. We all know the significance of maintaining good nutritional health in order to maintain overall health. And so that's what we do. We provide meals in congregate settings, mostly at senior centers throughout the country, and then we provide home-delivered meals to those who are homebound and cannot get out to a congregate setting. One of the goals and purposes of our nutrition program, while it provides meals, it also provides socialization. It is oftentimes the only person that the homebound see in the course of a day, that person, that home-delivered person, that delivery person. And we are so pleased that we've had hundreds of thousands of volunteers, people who give up their time, their energy, and their hearts in order to improve the health, whether it's the physical health, nutritional health, or the mental health, by avoiding depression and social isolation.
What are some of the things that you miss about not living on the neck?
I think it's similar to the other answer I gave, which is I miss the sense of community. And I don't know that it's there now. I know it was there when I was there. I really long for that sense of community, that sense of a village, the sense of caring for one another and looking after one another and being appropriately intrusive into someone else's life. Not inappropriately, but appropriately. Enough to say, I love you, I care for you, I'm a helping hand if you need it, but I'm also going to respect your independence and allow you to live your life. And I really love the beauty of the Northern Neck. It is, I used to call it a hidden gem, but it's been found out by a lot of people because I come down there now and I'm seeing all of these houses along the water and I'm like, oh my goodness gracious. It has truly become a retirement haven. And I guess that's a good thing, but you know, it's a little different than I recall. I had a colleague, work colleague, who was one day in the lunch area. We had one little cafeteria area. And he was so excited. He was telling everybody at the table this wonderful place he and his wife had found. They were going to buy, they were buying a house down there. They were retiring. I was walking by and I heard him and I said, you bought a house where? In Heathsville? And I was like, excuse me, how in the hell did you find it? But it was, you know, and they are there. They love it. I couldn't pry them away if I tried to this day. They absolutely adore it and they have adopted it as home. And it truly has become their home. It's a beautiful place to live.
What are you the most proudest about what you have achieved?
I think I'm proudest of maintaining and being true and genuine to myself and to how I was raised and the values that I was raised with and the sense of what those above me, parents, grandparents, broader teachers, community, church family, all of that, all of which they invested in. I think I'm proud of the fact that I have done my best to maintain and to be true to what they wanted for us and wanted for all of us, which is to not just be successful, but to have a life that has meaning, a life that gives back to the community, a life that shares with others, and a life that enables other people to be productive and independent.
What advice would you want to give to young people who are still living on the neck and trying to decide what their future is going to be, or trying to decide what their future will be?
I think the advice I would give them is to first be aware, and then to respect the good grounding and the preparation for life that the Northern Neck provides. It really does provide, as I've indicated, good foundations in terms of church, school, community. And I truly believe, you know, I have to use myself, that I am who I am, and I have become what I've become and what I've achieved because of the Northern Neck Foundation and the encouragement and the opportunities that were provided. I said before, I often speak of it as being somewhat unique, because so many people who have left the Northern Neck with those foundations, they were all successful. They were all able to live productive lives and give back to society, which is the way we were taught. So my advice to young people today is be aware of what is in front of you. Be aware of what's available. Don't focus on the negative of this place is boring and it doesn't have this and it doesn't have that. All that glitters is not gold. And believe me, what you have there are the foundational keys to successful living.
If there was anything that you could do to bring about change in the Northern Neck, or what changes do you think should come about in the Northern Neck, what is it or what are they?
Well, I don't live there, and I'm not 100% sure of all the issues. I have heard from people that they would like access to better broadband and things like that. I understand that. Some people indicate that they don't feel totally connected to the rest of the world or have the full opportunity to avail themselves of all that's going on in the world. But the flip side of that is I also believe that to have people come back and remind those who are there of what the benefits have been of the Northern Neck, and how in many people's lives, the things that were bred into people from the Northern Neck really did become the keys to successful living, and that it's available to them too. It's a matter of just having the right perspective and understanding how to apply themselves. Back to my answer in terms of why I left on graduation night, there weren't other industries available to me that were of interest to me from an employment standpoint. And I can recall many times throughout my career when I come back for an event on the neck, and people, my family members would say, well, when you coming home? And I'd be like, what am I going to come home to do? And so people need industries in order to be employed and in order to provide productivity and to have a livelihood and of adequate measure. And from what I hear now, the neck is no longer cheap because, as you call them, the come-heres are there, and the economics of the neck are changing. The houses, I understand, are rather pricey. People need to be able to live in that kind of environment and not be relegated to just a portion of it.
Well, Edwin, I know that you are busy, and I so appreciate the fact that you took time off from your busy schedule to talk to me. Much success, not only in your career, all of your endeavors in trying to help the people of this nation within your capacity to do so. Thank you.
Thank you, Pixie. And I just want to applaud you for what you do in calling attention to the issues of the Northern Neck, highlighting the people who are from the Northern Neck, and providing this as an educational service and an inspirational service to others. So thank you.
Thank you, Edwin. You have a good day. Thank you.
All right.
And
thank you.
No peaches for you, okay?
You got it. All right.
All right, Edwin. Thank you.
Thank you. See you later. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. ACL.gov The Administration for Community Living website has an extensive directory. Here are just a few of the links that can be accessed on their website for support services. Adult Protection Services. Advancing Care for Holocaust Survivors. Older adults with a history of trauma and their family caregivers. Advisory Council to support grandparents raising grandchildren. Support for people with Alzheimer's disease. Programs for American Indians, Alaskan Natives, and Native Hawaiians. American with Disabilities Act National Network. Behavior Health. Support for people with dementia. HIV, AIDS. Retirement Planning and Pension Support. Veteran Directed Care Program. World Elder Abuse Awareness Day. And Meals on Wheels. Some of the activities Edwin participated in as a student at Northumberland High School are still valuable pathways available to high school students today. Whether it's called Student Council, the Student Government Association, or SGA, or even Student Union, the organization is very much still a viable part of high school student life. And it could provide many opportunities to challenge yourself and help to map out a plan for the future. Joining or being part of your student government could help in preparing young people to make a positive impact on their educational experience and the world. Participating in your school's forensics or debate team could help you in analytical processing and public speaking. Necessary tools to navigate the ever-changing world of policy shaping and effectively communicating with an audience on any platform. Knowing how to appeal to and understand a wider spectrum of opinions and ideas could possibly give you a sense of empowerment and confidence. Your contributions for a better world can start with knowing how to talk to the person in front of you. Even the smallest decision to make a change is a huge step forward. Prepare yourself to be great. The action of denying someone a basic right. Riding on a new school bus. Having a promised milkshake in a shiny cup. Drinking it at the front part of the soda fountain counter, or just anywhere at the counter without consequences like any other regular child or adult. Being considered for advancements based on your qualifications and not a perceived notion of privilege. Values and traditions help shape everyone to be successful and empathetic to the needs of others, particularly the elderly citizens of our villages and of the native people. His passion for giving back to the community of the world allowed him to seek and implement the resources and solutions to assist those who struggled to live a fulfilling life because of limited resources available to them, but particularly for those living on the fringe of society. To use the indignities suffered by so many for so long, to use them to propel action and commitment by assisting the marginalized people of a nation that count itself as the standard for freedom and equality are the stepping stones used for the path that led to a future and ultimately to success for many residents of the Northern Neck. Pride, dignity, respect, and determination are the stones used to make paths that were used to leave the Northern Neck and to hopefully will be used by others still on a path of discovery and service while being Black on the Northern Neck. The music by Robert A. Hall. This interview is dedicated to those who give comfort and to those who give hope. Thank you for listening.